Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What sort of woman could inspire one of the most influential marble portraits of the Baroque era, only to commit a betrayal that would drive her sculptor lover to an act of shocking violence? Gianlorenzo Bernini's portrait of Costanza Piccolomini depicts the head and shoulders of a remarkably lifelike woman, seemingly captured in a moment frozen in time, simultaneously youthful and matronly, intelligent and sensual. For much of the nearly four centuries since the bust was carved, little was known for certain about its subject beyond her affair with the artist. But as my guest today has discovered, Costanza Piccolomini rose from genteel poverty to great wealth by the force of her will and the power of her intellect, perhaps aided by the enchantment of her beauty. Sarah McPhee is Winship Distinguished Research Professor of Art History at Emory University and author of Bernini's Beloved, A Portrait of Costanza Piccolomini. The Kimball Art Museum in Fort Worth, by the way, is hosting the exhibition Bernini Sculpting in Clay through April 14th. Sarah, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
For those who haven't seen the bust of Costanza, and we'll say there is an image from your book on our website if they're curious, but can you describe it for us?
Sure. The marble portrait bust of Costanza Piccolomini is a more or less life-size bust in marble that depicts the woman as if she were about to speak. Her lips are slightly open. Her eyes are trained on a point in the distance. Seen from the front, her hair is sort of disheveled and fulsome, but as you circulate around the bust, you see different aspects of her character rendered in the stone. From the rear, she appears like a sort of aristocrat. She has rather tightly coiled braid at the back of her head. From the right side, she looks a bit matronly, and from the left, like a maiden. So he's showing different sides of her character in the stone.
What reception did it get when it was first revealed, and what would have made it so striking to artists and even patrons in 17th century Rome?
Oh, this is a very good question. Well, you know, initially, she really wasn't revealed because of all Bernini's portrait busts, and he's famous for them. He made portrait busts for all of his major patrons, the popes of Rome. He made a very famous bust of Louis XIV of France and of Charles I of England. But what sets her apart is that, at least we are told by the biographers and have no reason to doubt, that he made her in marble for himself. Mm. And this sets her apart. Soon after the end of the affair and the famous flashing of her face, he gave her away, and that is when her reception actually begins. Mm-hmm. She becomes a kind of diplomatic gift in the immediate wake of all of these dramatic events in her and Gianlorenzo's lives.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about, first of all, the shorthand facts that were known about her by art historians before you decided to delve into all this, and what made you so confident that there was a lot more to be found?
Well, we knew very little about her. For one thing, we always have called her Costanza Bonarelli, mm-hmm. and that was the surname Bonarelli was what art historians called her sculptor husband, Matteo, who worked for Bernini. But that, too, turns out to be wrong.
It wasn't his last name either.
No, his name was Bonuccelli, and it was just a scribal mistranscription. But we actually knew very little about her. We knew, one, from the 60s, there was the 1960s, there was a document that was discovered in Florence that told the whole story of the affair and the slashing, and that was about it. So we knew that she was the wife of someone who had worked for Bernini, and that she'd had this affair with him, and that she'd had a subsequent affair with his brother, and that Bernini had then commissioned the slashing of her face in retribution. Mm. But that was about it. And then you asked, how was I confident?
Yeah, what made you think that if you just tried hard enough, you would find all this?
Well, you know, I'd always wondered who she was because she has such a riveting gaze. I'd seen her for the first time when I was 19 and made a trip to visit the Bargello Museum in Florence. But and then, you know, she's one of the kind of galaxy of characters you carry around in your head if you work on the 17th century in Rome. But I was working in Sweden among the papers of a student of Bernini's when I was reading through his diary and chanced upon the fact that he had seen her portrait in the Uffizi in Florence in 1677 or so, and he said that, yes, this was the portrait of his master's most beautiful favorite, but that when she died, she had died incredibly rich. And this, I thought, was completely shocking because, of course, given the documents that had been known to date, we thought she was a woman of the people who was probably illiterate and from the streets of Rome. And instead, he said she was rich. So, you know, I filed that away. But then working a few years later in Paris, I came across the fact that her name, right there, hiding in plain sight, was actually Costanza Piccolomini. So Piccolomini is the name of two Renaissance popes, and you put that name together with died rich, and I knew that there would be some trace of her, or suspected that, in the Roman archives. So I went to Rome and began my hunt, and it, 8 years later, I was able to find, I never dreamt I would find all I did, but with thousands of documents.
So Costanza was a member, she was born into what had been a very prominent family, although her branch of it had fallen into hard times by the time she came along. You mentioned the papal relatives. What made the Piccolomini name such an asset to her?
Well, because there had been two Renaissance popes with that name, and it was a very distinguished family from Siena. She was actually born in Viterbo, a town about an hour north of Rome, but it was from this line. Her will bears the sealing wax and seal of the line of Pius II Piccolomini. So she was, by birth and name, linked to Renaissance popes. And all over Rome, you see the tombs and heraldry of these popes. So even as a young girl growing up in a relatively modest family in the city of Rome, she would have seen her forebears, her illustrious forebears. And with a name like that, she could, she would have had certain access to things. She would have had an access, well, above all, to a sense of self that was different. But as she aged and as she grew up and made her way through life and working, as I suggest in the book, and building a very active studio of sculpture and painting, she then became, during the course of her life, very close to the reigning pope, Alexander VII Chigi, in the last years of her life. And the Chigi family intermarried with the Piccolomini, not she, but with other members in Siena, which must have raised her fortunes as well.
And yet, when she was a teenager, her father lacked the funds to pay her dowry himself.
Exactly. She received dowries from two religious organizations in Rome who raised money to dower young girls to prevent them from falling, as they said, into the jaws of the devil by not having enough money and then, of course, going into prostitution. So, yes, her father did not have the funds. He was probably a steward or footman in a princely household, but they were living in a small house with no servants, right in the center of Rome. I was able to find them when she was about 14.
And this is fascinating, these societies. I knew nothing about them. These sort of religious groups would get together, and it was almost like a scholarship fund.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. But for moral purposes.
So we know that she was not only literate, but quite intelligent. And remarkably, you found documents written in her own hand?
Yes. Well, this was, you know, the search through the archives is a taste one develops, and when either has it full tilt as I do or not at all. Mm-hmm. But I find it just extraordinarily compelling. And one of the moments in this research that was a really sort of lightning bolt from beyond, I was it was the autumn of 2001, and I was actually in the archive pursuing what I imagined would be a court case that Matteo, her husband, would have brought against Bernini for having slashed her face and basically destroying his property. Mm-hmm. And I looked for 3 months for such documents in the tribunal archives of the Rome State Archive and found nothing. And I was nearing, I was getting very frustrated with this project and nearing abandonment. I'd found her inventory and her will, but I hadn't found any other trace. And I turned the page of the notarial document I was working on, and there was a letter in her hand writing to the governatore, or head of the prison system, state government system in Rome at the time, asking for release from the house for badly married women where she was incarcerated following the slashing.
Yeah, so just to back up, and we're going to have to get all these details. No, it's great. She was the one who got punished for having had the affair.
Correct. So here I had thought Bernini would be fined, as his son says in the biography he was, but he also says he was exonerated. And instead, she's removed from society. She's placed in forcible confinement for a period of 4 months in this house for malmaritate, or badly married women. And in fact, she's living on handouts, as she says in the letter, from other women in order to survive. Hmm. And so it was really, it shocked me, because I had expected something completely different, but the archives yield up their secrets and push you in new directions. And by finding the letter, I realized also that she's literate, because the letter is written in her hand. I know from the will, you can compare the way she makes her own, she signs her own name. Mm. So it was certainly she writing, and she's asking for release.
Where would she have gotten her education?
Well, in 17th century Rome, the popes supplied an education for the local poor in something called the Rioni schools. So Rome is divided into 14 neighborhoods, or Rioni, and the papacy paid for a local schoolmaster to train the poor. Now, these classes were intermittent and so forth, and they were also supplied catechism classes on Sunday. So she may have been educated that way. There were channels available. They grow over the course of the 17th century, and they would have been quite spotty at the start, but she may have been educated that way.
Hmm. My guest is Sarah McPhee. She is Winship Distinguished Research Professor of Art History at Emory University and author of the new book Bernini's Beloved, A Portrait of Costanza Piccolomini. The exhibition Bernini Sculpting in Clay, by the way, is on view at the Kimball Art Museum through April 14th. If you'd like to join the conversation, which we'll resume in a couple of minutes, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. The Kimball Art Museum in Fort Worth is hosting the exhibition Bernini, Sculpting in Clay through April 14th. We are speaking this hour with Sarah McPhee, who is Distinguished Research Professor of Art History at Emory University and author of the new book Bernini's Beloved, A Portrait of Costanza Piccolomini. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Sarah, what do we know about how Costanza came to marry Matteo?
Well, we know that that Costanza, you mean how they met and so forth? We're not really quite sure, although we know that he was involved at the time of the granting of one of the dowries. Mm-hmm. And that they married in 1632 in the small church of San Lorenzo in Lucina in the center of Rome.
And for those of us who are not familiar with that system, marriage was much more a business contract at that time. And if you ended up falling in love with someone, so much the better. But can you talk about what that sort of dowry contract looked like?
Sure. The dowry contract was essentially a detailing of the exchange of goods between Costanza's father, Lorenzo Piccolomini, and Matteo Bonuccelli. And the oratory of the Gonfalone and the Church of San Rocco were the two entities, the religious entities, that had granted Costanza dowry funds. And she was then essentially worth marrying for Matteo, because during the course of their marriage, he would be able to control those funds, invest them, use them, as long as he was able to restore them to her at his death or at the dissolution of their union, for whatever reason. But she had to come with funds, or I don't think she would have been a good match for him.
So he was working as an artist, as an assistant to Bernini. What sort of work would a job like that entail?
Well, he was a sculptor, and he appears to have been an extremely successful sculptor in his own right, above all in the restoring of ancient sculpture, which was being unearthed constantly in Rome as new buildings were built and soil was disturbed. We know that he began working for Bernini at least as early as 1636, because he appears in the payment documents at St. Peter's, where he is carving on projects that Bernini would have designed. So, for example, the tomb of Countess Matilde in the church is designed by Bernini and then executed by a team of sculptors working for him. Matteo was one of those sculptors.
And we don't know exactly, am I right, how Costanza ended up modeling for Bernini, but it might have been the kind of thing that it wouldn't be unusual for an assistant to say, oh, you can use my wife as a model.
Well, modeling for Bernini, we don't know. Mm-hmm. Modeling for this portrait bust, certainly, yes. But how exactly they met and what the nature of the liaison was, we just don't have the evidence to know. I speculate in the book that Costanza may have, been the unwilling partner in this romantic liaison between the two. She was fair game as the wife of someone working for Bernini. She's much, much younger than he is, mm-hmm. and the same age, more or less, as Bernini's younger brother. So we just don't know. She certainly modeled for this portrait bust, but whether or not she was the model for the charity in the tomb of Urban VIII, as is sometimes said, mm-hmm. and by the way, there's a terracotta in the show showing that charity, we can't actually say.
And so it's possible that she might have worked with him or developed a relationship with him to protect her husband's job?
Well, that she, it was not at all uncommon for husbands in this period to actually extend that benefit to people in their circle.
Goodness.
And this may have been the case. I invoke the image of the biblical Susanna, preyed upon by the elders, because she may not have had much of a choice.
We've come a long way, baby.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so we know that whatever the circumstances, there was an affair between Costanza and Bernini, but actually two Berninis, and you alluded to this earlier.
Right, exactly. Well, they are involved in whatever form of liaison, and then the thing that leads to the violence is that Bernini discovers his younger brother emerging from the document says, it's quite colorful, so I'll recount it a little bit, but the document says that Bernini told his brother and family that he was leaving town for the country. He suspected something. So he hooked up harnessed his horses, and the coachman took him off, but he didn't leave town. He came back, circled around, and parked his horse nearby the door to Costanza's house, and he watched. And at a certain point, he sees his own brother emerging, accompanied to the door by Costanza in her bedclothes. Having discovered this this betrayal, this affair, he then sends a servant with two flasks of Greek wine to present them to Costanza, and as she holds those flasks, he slashes her face. So he commissions the retribution.
I don't, you know, we'll have to talk about slashing, and I know it was sort of a common thing, but it's made all the more bizarre by the fact that Bernini did not commit this crime of passion himself.
Right, but it actually was quite common to commission such a crime because the punishment for slashing was, at least on the books, was banishment, and even worse. I mean, it could lead to death. It's considered an absolutely terrible crime on the books. So you have someone else do it for you, and it's quite common in slashing was quite common in a kind of barroom situation between men brawling and so forth. It's also quite common as a retribution against prostitutes who have ceased to service their patrons, but to slash the face of a respectable matron in society was to call her a prostitute, to mark her forever, and to destroy the mirror of her honor, her face.
And this was so relatively common that there were like medical textbooks that had sections to say, if a patient comes to you and she's been slashed, this is what you do.
Exactly. Well, this was marvelous, actually, because a friend at a certain point said to me, well, how did you repair a face in the 17th century, which, of course, launched me into reading for several months on plastic surgery. And lo and behold, the Italians were at the vanguard in the Renaissance of plastic surgery because slashing and nose cutting were so common as retribution for adultery, especially in the south of Italy, that the medical doctors evolved a means of grafting skin from the arm across the bridge of the nose to repair these things. And yes, there are diagrams in medical textbooks for how to repair the slashed cut of a cheek and not have it show too much. Using a form of butterfly bandage to hold the skin together.
Is the nose slashing where we get the expression cutting off one's nose despite one's face?
That's a very good thought. I don't know.
Huh. Okay, so she is slashed, and Bernini is fined apparently, but then exonerated. She goes off into this forced confinement. She writes this letter and says, "I'm not even being fed here," and she's remanded to the custody of her husband, who takes her back.
Right, which is another puzzling twist. Except if you think that perhaps the initial liaison was not without his knowledge, and therefore, when he died, the parish priest wrote of her husband that he was a wonderful man whose generosity astonished the entire world. Mm-hmm. And that's I've thought about that a great deal over the course of these years, just wondering exactly what he meant. But he did take her back, and they thrived as a working couple together over the course of the next decade or so.
So let's talk about the business they built together.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, they were collecting art first privately and then selling and trading, that sort of thing?
Sure. Remember, Matteo is a very successful restorer of sculpture. So his house, not surprisingly, is full. By the way, they lived in a quite lovely house that still exists at the foot of the Quirinal Hill, just below the Papal Palace, also in the center of Rome.
You have a photograph. Were you able to go into the house?
Yes, and that's a whole other story, but I haunt her street and her house. I pass it every time I'm in Rome, and I often try to get a glimpse into the courtyard or maybe even ring the bell and bother someone who lives there. And this summer, actually, I was outside it, and an attractive man in his early 60s emerged from the portal and saw me there and said, "May I help you?" And I said, "Yes, well, I'd really like to go into the courtyard." And he said, "Well, you can." And so we went in together, and I began to tell him about the 17th century life of the house and the fact that there had been a foundry there and a fountain. And then that this woman I just finished a book about had lived on the piano nobile, the second floor, and her rooms had faced the street. And he smiled and said, "That's my apartment. Would you like to see it?" So yes, we went up. But it is a house on four stories with a beautiful courtyard and quite a large structure. And she outfitted it with all kinds of inlaid floors and fancy pilasters and things. So it was there was quite a bit of pretense in the house as well. And they had 75 sculptures, mostly ancient. And that's significant. That's a huge number of sculptures for a collection at this time. And the fact that they were ancient, those are worth a great deal of money. She also had 112 paintings and a gallery filled with paintings to a gallery for display. Galleries were a sign of patrician status, of nobility in that period, and among her collections were five paintings by the French painter Nicolas Poussin. And today their works hang in the Louvre and the Prado and the Vatican and so forth. So it was an extremely interesting and good collection. It began with personal relationships. I believe Matteo knew Poussin, but as the years went forward, Costanza began, I have some evidence, to sell her paintings and invest the proceeds. And her Plague at Ashdod, which is the Poussin that hangs in the Louvre, she tries to sell to Mazarin at a certain point. So we have very important patrons from around Europe actually showing up at this house in Rome to attempt to buy her art.
So for people, Sarah, who are thinking, okay, well, they had this terrible incident with Bernini, and then they moved on and lived happily ever after. In fact, Matteo Bonicelli continued working for Bernini until he died.
Until his death, yes. And in fact, if you walk from Bernini's house in Via della Mercede to Costanza's house, it will take you about 3 minutes on foot. Rome was incredibly small. These people were still seeing one another on a weekly, if not daily, basis. Matteo certainly daily. And then after Matteo's death, Costanza becomes extremely close with a man who is also a fellow called Domenico Salvetti, who is employing Bernini and his brother to refashion a villa nearby Costanza's house, where Costanza certainly went, and after her death, where her entire collection goes. Mm. So there are all kinds of ties that continue to link Bernini to Costanza to the end of her days.
And Salvetti was also the person that Costanza made arrangements to have her daughter cared for upon her own death.
Exactly. She leaves behind, and she dies at the age of 48, and she leaves behind an eight-year-old daughter. And she names two guardians for the daughter, one of whom is Domenico Salvetti, and he takes the lead role in that position for the 2 years that he outlives her. Mm-hmm. And one of his tasks, I believe he may be the daughter's father as well, but that's another story.
Yeah, the timing doesn't work out really right for the daughter to have been Matteo's.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's quite impossible. I was able to find lovely numbers of documents on the daughter, including the accounting books for all of her expenses, her ruby ring, her silver spoon, and so forth. And it's really quite clear that her birthdays fall too far from Matteo's own illness and death to make her make it possible for him to be the father. But Domenico oversees the sale of all of these paintings and sculptures, and in the meantime moves them all to the villa just up the hill from her house. And it's there that her collection pools with his own, and the astonishing thing is that it is filled with Berninis. In fact, there are 25 terracotta sculptures in the collective collection of Costanza and now Domenico, and five of them are in the show in Fort Worth. Hmm. So that's a nice twist as well.
That show in Fort Worth, Bernini Sculpting in Clay, is on view at the Kimball Art Museum through April 14th. We're speaking this hour with Sarah McPhee. She's Winship Distinguished Research Professor of Art History at Emory University and author of the new book, Bernini's Beloved, A Portrait of Costanza Piccolomini. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with art historian Sarah McPhee of Emory University. Her new book is called Bernini's Beloved, A Portrait of Costanza Piccolomini. You can see the exhibition Bernini Sculpting in Clay at the Kimball Art Museum in Fort Worth through April 14th. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Sarah, one interesting detail I learned about the period in Rome from your book was the idea that clothing was considered a major asset of one's estate. And it seems that Costanza spared no expense for herself or for her daughter, Olympia.
Yes, she had rather spectacular clothes. And with this project, each item I would read in the inventory, I would try to understand what it meant. And reading my way into the value of clothes was a very surprising avenue. She had clothing that was made of silk and velvet and some cotton, but it was also sewn with gold thread and gold, and then adorned with gold buttons and silver lace and things like this. And she had probably 20 dresses. What was common in this period for a modest person, which is what we thought she had been, would be to have one outfit, one dress, and then change the bodices, change the sleeves, and so forth. Instead, she had and abundance. And each one of these things is valued in the will, given a scooty value, and they're worth quite a lot. In many cases, worth more than paintings.
Hmm. So, what happened to Olympia after Costanza died?
Well, she is, as I suggest, was cared for by Domenico Salvetti, her guardian. And when he died in 1664, 2 years after her mother, she is then cared for by Cesare Rasponi, who was the cardinal in Rome. But on a day-to-day basis, she is placed in the Convent of the Virgins in the center of Rome, and she's educated there. And what's interesting to compare is the life that Costanza provided for her daughter. Well, Costanza's literacy was hard won, and you can see it in the calligraphy of her letter. Her daughter had a beautiful hand and was raised as a noble among the Chigi daughters and other prominent families in the city of Rome. When she dies in 1736, so she has a very long life, her inventory runs to over 100 pages. She was a noble with a noble with the noble clothes and the noble accoutrement in her life. Costanza had provided for a noble's life for her daughter.
So, an interesting story as well is obviously is what happened to Bernini after all this. Essentially, he sort of went crazy, tried to kill his own brother, had his lover slashed, and then his family and the Pope got together and said, "Get with the program and find yourself a wife."
Exactly. And I mean, it's alluded to in all the biographical sources that that Bernini is essentially told by Urban VIII to take a wife, and he does, and he chooses the youngest daughter of a lawyer in Rome. This woman is named Caterina Tezio, and she and he go on to have 11 children, and his passion for his for women is thereafter channeled into his work, or so the biographies tell us. And you hear no more of slashings and affairs and so forth in Bernini's biography.
Did he ever sculpt his wife?
He never did. Costanza is, he did very few portraits of women. The other marble portrait that he does is of Urban VIII's mother, and it's a posthumous portrait, very modest, mm-hmm. and contained, but he made paintings of the other women in the women in the family, in the women in the family, his wife and so forth, but never another sculpted portrait. That he Costanza is really alone in that sense.
It is striking that if, as you mentioned, some have speculated that there is a rendering of someone who looks very much like Costanza in the carving that he made for Urban VIII's tomb.
Right. That this is. I'm very skeptical of this story because it grows out of a document that doesn't is dated to the end of the 17th century. Mm-hmm. And it tends to gather narrative steam subsequent to that and is not mentioned at all in documents that are contemporary with the tomb. And frankly, I don't think that physiognomically it works, but it may be. It's just the evidence isn't very convincing.
And how were other artists of the day and after that inspired by the bust of Costanza? I mean, does she appear elsewhere? Are people sort of taking inspiration from that bust?
Well, there are multiple copies of this bust over time. In fact, I have one sitting in front of me in resin, which I found in a garden shop outside Atlanta.
Wow.
But I know, isn't that funny? But she appears in a variety of marbles and bronzes that were based on her, and this is a wonderful thing. With time, she evolves. She loses her identity as Costanza Piccolomini, and she actually becomes paired with Adonis. She becomes Venus. So it's interesting, the response. She really becomes the beloved in this the sort of ur-mythological sense of Venus as the goddess of love and beauty.
So she was able to clean up her image posthumously, or even in her own life. By the end of her life, was she considered respectable once again? Would her neighbors have forgiven her transgressions if she'd sort of done her time?
Well, it's interesting because after her death, she has to turn over, in her will, she turns over a third of her worldly goods to the Magdalens.
Right, the people that took her in and sort of forced her to stay.
Exactly. She was a publicly fallen woman, so she had to do that. That was one of the laws in Rome at the time. But she was buried inside the Porta Santa, or the Holy Door, of Santa Maria Maggiore, which is one of the four patriarchal basilicas of Rome, in the same basilica where Bernini would join her some years later in the Bernini family tomb. And they're both in the same church. This is not a pauper's grave. This is the grave of an illustrious person. So I think she managed to pull things together by the end of her life in quite a remarkable way.
Sarah, how does everything that you've learned change what you see when you look at that bust?
Well, this was the question that I thought was so interesting about the book in general, was what do you bring to a portrait when you know very little about the sitter's biography, especially if it's a speaking likeness that aims to capture character? And if you only know that she had a torrid affair with the artist, you'll find her décolletage and fiery eyes to look like something rather sexy. But if you know more about the biography, and you know that she was literate, she was intelligent, she built a career, she built a collection, and so forth, as you circulate around this portrait, you might see a bit more. You might see the nobility of her name in her hair, in her tightly coiled braid, or the line of her neck, and so forth, the incipient middle age. You see different things, because in portraiture, one projects, I think, a bit of what one knows about the person. And so biography is essential to portraiture. And without it, we saw one thing. With it, you see something totally different.
Sarah McPhee is Winship Distinguished Research Professor of Art History at Emory and author of Bernini's Beloved, A Portrait of Costanza Piccolomini. The Kimmel Art Museum in Fort Worth is hosting the exhibition Bernini Sculpting in Clay through April 14th. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
For the last few minutes of today's program, we wanted to remind you of the special programming on KERA TV Channel 13 tonight at 7. Tune in then for Erasing the Stigma, Mental Illness and the Search for Solutions, a joint presentation from KERA, the Dallas Morning News, and Dallas Mayor Mike Rawlings. Taped live at the Dallas City Performance Hall on February 5th, Erasing the Stigma features a panel of community leaders and experts, including State Representative Garnett Coleman. KERA's Shelley Koffler brought us his story earlier this month. Let's listen.
Mr. President, the House and Gallery, please rise for the invocation.
22 years ago, when newly elected Garnett Coleman first walked onto the floor of the Texas House, he was battling a debilitating illness he didn't understand. What he knew was that periodically, a paralyzing wave of depression would hit him like a sledgehammer, with paranoia and anxiety so overwhelming, he'd crawl into bed and sleep for days.
Not eating, not doing anything, this isn't sleep. This is escape, mental escape. It's not being sad. You look at yourself as worthless.
The periods of deep depression started when Coleman was 16. He'd eventually be diagnosed as having bipolar disorder, a treatable condition of the brain that causes unusual shifts in mood, energy, and the ability to carry out daily activities. Coleman remembers wanting to hide where no one could find him.
When I said that I slept in my closet, that was because sleeping in the bed wasn't good enough because somebody might look in the window and see me there. So what I needed to do was go in the closet.
So you slept in the closet.
Mm-hmm.
You slept a lot. Did you have friends and a social life?
No. I mean, people would come and try to find me, but no, basically, no.
The periods of depression would lift and Coleman would try to lead a normal life. but the darkness always returned through the 11 years it took him to complete college as he courted his wife and married after he was elected to the Texas legislature. Then in 1994, Coleman's father, a physician, died, and Coleman really disappeared.
I left and was missing for about 60 days to 90 days.
You just got in your car and drove away?
Drove away.
Just Where'd you go?
To a hotel, you know, check in, go in the room, turn off all the lights, pull the curtains, and then be in there and sleep for 5 days. I wouldn't let anybody in to clean the room or anything like that, and I'd get all, you know, certainly paranoid. But then I would leave when I thought somebody was going to find me.
The episode was a turning point.
I knew that if I got depressed at the levels I was depressed in for the time, I would kill myself.
Coleman checked into a leading psychiatric hospital where doctors diagnosed his condition. They provided the important combination of medicine and counseling that allows him to lead a productive life today.
Hey, Jesse, how are you?
Good, good.
How are you, sir?
Everything going okay?
While he doesn't hide his condition from colleagues in the Texas House, some, including Representative James White from Woodville, are surprised when they learn Coleman has bipolar disorder.
I didn't know it. And I do know of him as being someone that's very passionate and focused on policy.
Others who do know, like Representative Helen Giddings of Dallas, say Coleman's condition may be the reason he's the body's recognized expert on public health and a tireless advocate for the mentally ill.
He's spoken out, we listen to him, and he makes a huge difference and has done a ton of good in the state in terms of trying to help us set the right course in terms of mental illness.
Coleman says the right course now is to use an opportunity following the Newtown school shootings to educate the public and find help for those who are suffering. While most mentally ill people are more of a danger to themselves than others, Coleman believes large-scale tragedies can be prevented.
We need for people to know that you have to intervene early in any illness, and that includes mental illness. So if it is that individual that might have a tendency to shoot others, you know, as a danger to others, then we need to catch them at the time when it's just developing.
Representative Coleman says he'll never be cured. He still occasionally has episodes, and he'll have to take medicine for the rest of his life. But he says that's true for people with diabetes or heart disease.
I take my pills in the morning and I go to work just like anybody else.
With proper treatment, mental illness for many can be managed. Shelley Koffler, KERA News.
You can hear more from Representative Garnett Coleman and others tonight on Erasing the Stigma, Mental Illness, and the Search for Solutions. It airs at 7 o'clock on KERA Channel 13. Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. And, of course, we always welcome your comments, your questions, and your suggestions. Email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.